Coming up next week, Ego, the fall of the Twin Towers and the rise of an enlightened humanity. We'll have one of the authors on of Ego. It's a very interesting discussion about exactly what has happened to us since then. There's a piece I just saw on CNN, actually, about that, about the impact that 9/11 has had on world religions. Peter Bauman is a former member of the internationally acclaimed band Tangerine Dream. I remember that. Remember that from the, was that Sorcerers, the name of the movie that they used that famous sequence from Tangerine Dream? Like their stuff. Anyway, we'll be talking about that. It's a book to explores the positive evolutionary potential hidden in what appears to be one of the most destructive events in history. And that's next Saturday night on Coast to Coast. If you missed the first hour, you can go back on Coast Insider and listen to The President is a Sick Man, the story of something that Grover Cleveland was able to pull off toward the end of the 19th century, never fully before discussed episode in history. Grover Cleveland survived a secret surgery at sea, and the guy who knew the truth attempted to expose it, and he paid dearly for it from a guy who had previously been thought of as the most honest man in America. And that brings us right back to the zombie autopsies. We'll continue that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Stephen Schlossman is an expert in psychiatry. He's trained in psychiatry, joined the faculty at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, where he is currently an assistant professor of psychiatry. And we've been talking about zombieism, both as it exists in nature and as it exists in the zombie autopsies, secret notebooks from the apocalypse. We had mentioned before, we had talked a little bit about mad cow disease and then Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, the human version of that. And Dr. Stephen, I want to read something here to you, okay? This comes from a Reuters Health article back in 2002. It says, the human form of mad cow disease is hard to diagnose early on, which kind of reminded me of the discussion about stage one zombieism, right? What things look like it. But UK researchers have put together a profile of symptoms that may help catch cases sooner. You know, it's called a brain wasting condition, largely one of anxiety, depression, and other psychiatric symptoms. So somebody could have Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, be right there in front of a doctor, and be completely misdiagnosed as having something else. Kind of like stage one of zombieism.
Right, right.
Okay.
I mean, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's is a rare condition. So that's part of why we can, you know, sort of get away with that. It's not that common. What makes ANSD creepy is its airborne nature means that if it goes the direction that it appears to be going, at least from these notebooks, it will become quickly more common.
But here's where I'm going with this, is that you make a great point about that it's not common, except that there have been about 100 people who have been confirmed or very likely, like a high probability of CJD, who have died from CJD in Britain. And that Britain seems to be kind of like the center point for people for both mad cow disease and the human equivalent of mad cow disease. And I wondered, this is also true for France, Ireland, and Italy. And I wondered whether that's why you think the outbreak for ANSD took place on that island wasn't it off the Irish coast?
Yeah, in the Aran Islands. I mean, that's certainly one of the working theories right now, that the people who decided if this were a manufactured organism, they were able to build upon what already existed in nature and had been seen over and over again in kind of naturalistic labs, you know, as you point out, throughout northern Europe, basically northern and western Europe.
How do Irish officials, how does a country like that, when they obviously there's tourism involved, they depend on people feeling welcome to come to the, you know, to the Emerald Isle. But you've got this, you know, potential disease lurking out there. How did the government handle that? Did they do it right?
it's boy, you know, hindsight's 20/20. At the time, first of all, they didn't know what they were looking at first. So the initial reports, you know, when there was an initial ferry boat disaster where essentially a ferry boat, they lost contact with one of the ferries that goes to the westernmost island of the Aran Islands. When the Irish Navy went out to sort of fetch them, they didn't come back either. So I mean, it really does sound like something out of a cheesy horror movie, except it happened.
Right.
And the government decided that you know, this has got to be something, an isolated incident. We need to study this as carefully as we can. I think they responded, as many governments would at the time, let's not jump to conclusions. Let's make sure we understand exactly what's going on. But by that time, it looks like the ANST virus had sort of gotten out of the, you know, Pandora's box was opened at that point. It's gotten out.
Yeah. And the Pandora's box seems to be something in the soil. In that part of the country, part of the world, rather. And I wonder whether it brings us back to that discussion about how the zombie fungus that takes over ants and eventually works its way inside of an ant. The ant can be exposed to it on the outside, but the fungus immediately starts to break through the exoskeleton of the ant, gets inside the ant, and controls its behavior. To put it up at a certain level in the rainforest so it doesn't go up too high. The fungus knows not to go up too high. Gets the ant to essentially die underneath, clinging onto a leaf, on the underside of a leaf to protect it from the rain and to keep it at the perfect incubating temperature. And that's so interesting. That's a high level of intelligence. It's not just the ant goes randomly wherever the ant goes, and a certain number of these fungus-encrusted ants will then rain spores down onto the jungle floor. It's not a matter of that. The fungus can control how high up the ant can go. If the scientists have taken those ants that have been covered with the zombie fungus and moved it to a higher leaf, and it kills the fungus, or it makes it completely unpredictable of what will happen, and that they put it on a lower leaf, it ends up getting eaten by other insects. So there's like that perfect place, almost like a perfect incubating elevation or temperature that would create the zombie apocalypse of ants. And I wonder whether there's something about the British Isles and the soil that keeps giving us mad cow disease and the highest concentration of the human equivalent of that.
So that's one of the theories. I mean, with that fungus, with the ants, it stumbled around. There were probably a billion other versions of that fungus until it happened to mutate in such a way that it forced the ants to occupy the exact correct level, the niche, the correct biological niche in order to spread itself. When you look at things like mad cow or prions in general, they tend to be, the infectivity of them tends to be tied to the acidity of the soil. So the more acidic the soil, the more likely the prions themselves are to fold, and the more folding they do, the more deadly they become.
So okay.
That's one of the theories they're working with.
It's so interesting. When we're talking about prions, we're talking about these infected proteins. It's this sort of this conflated word for protein infection. Is that what it means again, prion?
Proteinaceous infections, yep.
Right. Okay, and so this has been implicated in brain changes amongst all sorts of things. Prions are not technically alive, but they still have this huge influence over the living organisms with which it interacts. It goes back to what we were talking about before, where certain pregnant women feel the need to go eat soil. And I wonder whether that could also be, whether that was the cause that started this, the zombification of the Aran Islands. Whether it could have been pregnant women who were driven to go eat soil and end up creating the same type of problem.
Well, you know, your guess is as good as mine on that. The all we know, all the notebooks tell us, is that the initial outbreak occurred in this fairly remote, you know, somewhat quaint westernmost island in the Aran Islands. How the bug got there and then how it got into the population is kind of up for grabs. You know, the bug right now is airborne. This is
right.
Spread through coughs. But at the time, we don't know.
Well, you know what? I'm not that, you know, who am I? You know, but that would be my theory, is that at some point, It comes out of the soil, and it might be driven by those type of obsessive behaviors. That, would you call it pica, again, that some women get during pregnancy? That might explain it. It's just like some women. I knew a woman who could only eat bacon while she was pregnant, and it couldn't just be bacon. It had to be fairly uncooked bacon. And what was even funnier is that is up until she got pregnant, she had maintained an almost perfectly kosher life. But it was the only thing she could eat. And it was like, she just couldn't grow. She had all this shame connected to it. And she couldn't even be crispy bacon. It had to be certain bacon, it's something weird about pregnancy like that, that it can drive certain people to. Now, let's talk about the Treaty of Atlanta and the protocols of the Atlanta Treaty, policymakers that made this decision in July of 2011 in Atlanta.
Yeah, so if in the book, this treaty is in one of the appendices of the book, so you can make sense of it. Basically, there are a couple things. You know, the zombies in the movies are reanimated. They're dead things that have come back to life and stumble around. Subjects with victims with stage 4 ANSD, they're still living. Their hearts are still beating. Their lungs are still breathing. But some decision had to be made about what their status was as humans. At least this was the decision of the UN. So ecumenical leaders, it was essentially a philosophical religious decision. Ecumenical leaders got together and sort of declared folks with stage 4 NSD to have what they called NLH status, or no longer human status, meaning that they were either at best not human, and at worst, really not, for all intents and purposes, still alive. And they decided that funeral rites, you know, specific to that person's culture and heritage were okay at that point. And that further, it was permitted and even expected that people with stage 4 ANSD were no longer people and therefore needed to be dispatched. At that point, there's no cure.
So right.
They had to do what they had to do.
This is reminiscent, perhaps, of like to go back to 9/11, of when the plane that was filled with people outside of Pittsburgh and was turning around to come back to Washington was brought down, as generally accepted, brought down by the passengers on the plane heroically, and sent, you know, tumbling into the ground. Some people say, well, it may have been shot down by a U.S. jet, you know, that scrambled after it to take it out before it could take out a building. But either way, it suddenly there's a certain point where you have to recognize that the greater good has to be served by, if you will, sacrificing what we could no longer. You can't look at just the fact that all of those people on that plane were human beings. We certainly see them as human, and we mourn them as human. But what they decided on that plane was they were better off going down than creating an even greater tragedy by returning to society, by returning to Washington, D.C., as it were.
Yeah, those kinds of decisions, those kinds of existential quandaries are much more common than we realize. If we start to think about, you know, events in history or just events that happened in the hospital, I think the creepy thing about these manuscripts is they bring to the forefront all of the common themes and tropes that we're used to seeing and sort of chuckling at in old zombie movies, and here it is in like a manuscript suggesting that it's all real.
Right.
You know, that's scary.
When you say in a hospital, what do you mean by that? I mean, you obviously you work out in the real world.
Yeah, so in the hospital you're often asked to make decisions appropriately. To make decisions along with the family. In fact, the family is the folks who drive these decisions through things like advanced directives about whether somebody's life sort of still constitutes a life. In other words, you know, when you withdraw life support, when is it time to do that? How do you make these very, very difficult decisions? And it's a central role of the hospital, doctors, clergy, nurses, all the folks from the hospital, and the families to sort of help them to make these decisions as best kind of meets their needs and the needs of the folks around them.
Yeah.
And they're not easy decisions, and there's no one kind of simple rule to follow either.
And yet you also have to keep in mind the legal implications, which brings us back to that Atlanta Treaty, in a way sort of preemptively exculpating the doctors, the police department, whoever would be considered the authority on the spot to cauterize a growing, you know, zombification, some sort of virus, some sort of prion.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, zombies, you can't call it self-defense because they're not really any more than you could call it self-defense when a crocodile attacks you. Crocodile is just doing what a crocodile does. It eats you. And so your job when a crocodile attacks you is to attack it back and hopefully either get away or kill it. So you can't really call it self-defense against a human because they haven't declared war on us. You can't call it a war because they haven't declared war on us. So the UN quickly recognized that they had to come up with kind of new definitions in order to give governments and individuals the powers they need in order to stay safe.
So what does that teach us about us? You know, what do we learn from that? How can we be better prepared for a coming zombie apocalypse? And what do we need to recognize about human nature in advance of the growth of something like this?
It's a really, really important question. I think that's the most important question, the one that's easy to miss because of all the sort of gory details which tend to grab your attention. Humans don't like it when the thing they're fighting doesn't seem to care much about them. We would very much like to have us matter. So something's going to tear your guts out. You'd like it to be about you. You'd like it to be personally about you. For zombies, it's really not personal. It really doesn't matter. For people with ANSD, it doesn't matter. It's not a personal thing. And so what humans tend to do, just like in those old movies, is they turn on each other. All that aggression that they're turning out on the zombies, you mentioned Max Brooks earlier, and he wrote about this for World War Z, when shock and awe doesn't work because you're incapable of being shocked and awe, it's not that you're not afraid, you just can't be afraid because
right.
you don't have a brain left to be afraid.
It doesn't work.
Right. All that aggression bounces back. There's actually a whole body of neurologic research on this called mirror neuron theory. All that aggression bounces back on you, and then it gets turned on each other. So our biggest enemies in fighting this pandemic, I would argue, is ourselves. We've met the enemy, and it is us, I think Pogo said, or Walker.
Yeah. Yeah, well, killer.
That's the scary part.
And so that's where, again, we have to start making mental decisions up front about what we would do. And we have to sort of be permissive, I think, and proactively about what would happen to us, say, within a family group if we were to become a zombie, sort of like how anybody would write a living will.
Yep.
And say, look, this is as much as the treatment as I want. Beyond this, you know, I want a DNR. Don't resuscitate me. And I think that might be the kind of thing that people have to actively talk about within a family is past a certain point, I'm not going to be dad. You know, after a certain point, I'm going to, whether I want it to be or not, I can't intellectualize the fact that you are anything other than perhaps my next meal. So don't think of me as dad because I don't think of you as son or daughter.
Right. So we've seen that and had a good time with that in the movies, and now we have to move away from the good time part. We've seen that moment where somebody gets bitten in the movies and then says, you know, when you see me start to change, don't let it happen to me. Go ahead and take
right. me. But I wonder how long it'll be before they modify the DNRs in hospitals.
It's a really interesting question because there's two things going on there. One is that person who says, you know, don't let it happen is essentially putting their family at risk because they're saying, wait until the last second and then do it, even though there's a kind of inevitability to it.
Right.
At the same time, the people who don't act right then and there are saying, you know, it's with all the right reasons, it's worth it to me to have you and to take that risk for the next couple of days because it's worth me to have you around.
I think I'm going to call my family attorney, and I'm going to have him modify my DNR, my living will, with my kids, and include zombieism in there, so they don't have to worry about that later on. Should it happen, they don't have to rationalize it. They don't have to say, "Oh, good, Dad's back." You know, no, don't do that. The zombie autopsy, secret notebooks from the apocalypse, Dr. Steven Schlotzman. Well. Many of you might suspect that there may not be as much here to worry about as we have indicated. Could it be? How much of what we've talked about is truth and how much of it is fiction? How much of it is fictionalized truth? We'll get into that coming up next. Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, I couldn't resist the third part of the zombie trilogy tonight here with Dr. Stephen Schlutzman. Of course, we've used a great book about what would happen in the world economies, which governments would react better to a zombie apocalypse. We did that with an esteemed economist who was great on the subject. And then, of course, we did have on Max Brooks in World War Z, the first time we've taken something like this, the fictional work of Dr. Stephen Schlutzman, who is, in fact, an associate assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. But he's also a writer of fiction and a longtime fan of popular culture and horror films. So we'll grab a couple of calls now that you know. I mean, come on, it's just for fun. But it's a really interesting subject. And how much of the zombie autopsies is real? How much of it is fiction? And how much of it is a cautionary tale that we should all be spending a lot more time thinking about? Maybe we won't be turning into zombies quite, but there are some problems with our medical system, with our military research, and those are exposed in the zombie autopsies. Just how could we be prepared for something like that? We'll get back to that with your phone calls, too, to join the conversation on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, let me just say, you're a really good sport, Dr. Stephen Schlutzman, the zombie autopsies, secret notebooks from the apocalypse. I'm sure I may have taken you well past your academic comfort zone by hanging in there with the fiction of it. But thank you. It was great. It was a really good time for me anyway.
Fun.
Good. So, you know, this is just then this, we'll wave a magic wand over the last 90 minutes or so and say that the information that we've been talking about, I would say if I had to put like percentages on it, I would say about 70% of what we said in that 90 minutes is 100% factually true.
Absolutely. No, I mean, that's the fascinating thing about this topic. And it is, as you said, loaded with cautionary tales.
Yeah. So just real quickly, and we've got some calls we want to get in on the conversation about the zombie autopsies. This is a novel, a graphically illustrated novel, I should remind. It's not a graphic novel, but it's graphically illustrated. What were the inspiration? Why did you go with the, and I was just guessing at it, why did you go with the Aran Islands as the zero point, as ground zero for the coming zombie apocalypse in your novel?
Your guess was right on. You know, we read about all of these mad cow outbreaks happening primarily, and they happen somewhat in Japan, but we read about them more maybe because we're in the West and the UK.
Right.
So I wanted that region of the world, and then I wanted a remote enough area that it would take a while for the news to be accurately relayed, even in this world where news tends to get out very, very quickly. Partly because of the quickness with which information is disseminated, there's all sorts of room for false information to be disseminated as well. So the creators of this horrific bug, and all hints are that this was a created organism, chose this island as a place that would allow them to sort of run their naturalistic experiment. And also, because they knew it was a tourist destination, they knew that then it would spread, because the tourists would become infected and go back to their homeland.
Okay, that's great. I was just stabbing at that, but I just love the fact that you went with that very credible line, as well as the way you talk about the World Health Organization, the UN, the CDC. Did you do some research on how you think they would react to a zombie apocalypse? I mean, or were you just fooling around?
Well, both. I was having fun with it in this kind of speculative fiction way, but it required me to do a lot of research to comb through all the UN treaties, at least all the ones that aren't confidential, are online. So you can dig them up. I went to the UN archives and read things. I sort of played around with the language of the UN and tried to duplicate that language as best I could. I looked at the way the CDC sort of screens out for pandemics, what their first actions are from a policy perspective and an individual perspective. I mean, it was fascinating research to do, and it lets you know also how if you ever read like The Hot Zone, for example, how close we get to these really nightmare scenarios.
Right.
How scary it is.
Yeah, and I think it is scary to think about something that Whether it was the bird flu or whether it's SARS or whether it was AIDS or whatever, that there is something about our human nature. It tends to either bring out the best in us or the worst of us, and that can decide whether or not that virus gets spread or contained. And sometimes it's the most reactionary or the most judgmental reactions to a disease that ends up creating a greater opportunity for it to spread.
Yep. No, that's, you can, Max makes that point, and other folks have made that point with HIV, with the early days of HIV.
Yeah.
If we have a hard time, we're humans, and so we have to be careful with ourselves, because it's very easy for our lower brains to get sort of more involved than we would like them to be at a given time. Keeping your cool actually is the best way to stay safe.
We'll take a couple of calls for Dr. Stephen Schlotzman, and then we'll do open lines for the last hour. Let me say, I tried to hint along the way, you know, that we were having fun with this, and that this was fiction, even though we were presenting it as fact. And I quoted from George Romero, who gave you a nice endorsement, the director of Night of the Living Dead, on the back of your book. But also, you had Seth Graham Smith, who is the guy who wrote Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, which I think is being made into a movie.
It is a movie. Yeah. Production.
And I tried to get him to do what you did, and he wouldn't do it. I tried to get him to come on the air and play Abraham Lincoln as Vampire Hunter and to talk about this as historical and true and everything. He wouldn't do it. I don't know why, but I couldn't get him to do it.
Well, I'll have to talk to him.
You did it beautifully. Yeah, he wouldn't budge. I tried personally. First-time caller line, Dave is in Atlanta on Coast to Coast for Dr. Stephen Schlotzman, the zombie autopsies. Dave? Oh, did we lose Dave right away? Oh, I picked up. Let me go to Jose in L.A. Jose?
Oh, yes. Good morning, Mr. Pundit. Good morning, Dr. Schlotzman.
Hi.
Mr. Pundit, I was wondering if I could ask two questions. Would that be okay?
Sure, as long as they're quick.
Okay. The first one is in regards to the zombie outbreak. Should we all do the Paul Redeker thing in World War Z and just get rid of our SEPTA mentality immediately, or should we have some kind of focus so that we don't get carried away and just let panic overrun us?
Dr. Schlotzman?
Maybe Ian could rephrase that, because I had a hard time understanding the question.
He was just talking about what should be our response. We're getting kind of a weird echo in the line. From World War Z, based on that, what do we learn from that to get us to make the right response when it comes up? How do we distance ourselves from it or stay engaged with it to the right degree?
It's a really good question. So I think there's a couple things to keep in mind. One is to sort of think as much as possible and as safely as possible algorithmically. It's much better to know what you're going to do ahead of time than to give yourself time to think. The slow-moving zombies don't pose much of a threat. You can eat a sandwich while you're running away from a slow-moving zombie. But that very fact that they don't pose much of a threat because they stumble, they can't walk real fast, they can't open the doors, things like that, gives we humans time to think. And all that time to think tends to get us into trouble. We tend to act in fairly aggressive and violent ways, as Max pointed out in World War Z. So I would say think algorithmically, know what you're going to do ahead of time so you don't respond limbically. You don't respond with that lower region of your brain. That'd be the first part. But then the second part is have room in there for thinking outside the box as well. The first thing you do when there's a horrible, you're in Southern California, when there's an earthquake is you fill the bathtubs up with water. You say water. You don't sort of run around and take care of what are less specific things. You want to sort of think the basics first. I think if we can pull together as humans, we would survive this.
Jose, you had a second question?
Yes. This past week on Monday, there was a short news segment about the possible resurgence of the H5N1 the flu virus. And I was wondering if governments are more prepared now than they were in the past, and whether that kind of thinking toward a flu pandemic might be used toward a zombie pandemic, for example, or would it be a specific change?
Thanks. Did you hear that, Stephen?
Yeah. I think the question was the news blip that came last week about the possibility, at least, of the H1N1 coming back more strongly this year than it did last year, and more like it did 2 years ago. Governments are already more prepared. The vaccines are available right now. People are being vaccinated for influenza right now. My kids just were. The sort of hindsight allows us to be better prepared going forward. And in fact, the CDC, I don't know, you probably saw this, but the CDC recently put on their blog a zombie preparedness guide, which was essentially equivalent to every disaster preparedness guide. So you can use the zombie construct to allow you to be prepared for any widespread disaster, including pandemics.
You know, it kind of reminds you of this movie Contagion, which is already premiered at the Venice Film Festival. Yeah, it's just about to come out. With Matt Damon and this sort of international all-star cast. And it, too, it seems like one of those movies, it seems like it was almost written to show us what we should do and what we shouldn't do. It almost seems like a syllabus when every time I see the trailer for it.
There's been movies. There was the one with Dustin Hoffman, I guess, about 10 years ago now.
Virus.
Outbreak. But this is the best. Well, Steven Soderbergh is a fantastic director, first of all, and this is the best one, exactly for the reasons that you said. From what I've seen in the trailers, I haven't been privileged enough to see it yet. But George is the one who told me about it first. George Romero did. It looks like it's exactly that. It's sort of how we might really lose ourselves, and how what we can do to keep our cool in order to save ourselves.
You know, the fact that it was directed by Steven Soderbergh gives me great hope that it's going to be great. Carlos is in Carson, California, on Coast to Coast. Carlos?
Yes, good evening. Doctor, I got a question here. In my 30 years of doing research on world events, I have become a very cynical person. And so when I read, for instance, that Dr. Leonard Horowitz describes how there are certain industries in Africa that are creating viruses like the Ebola viruses, throwing it on the population, making it appear as if it was just a natural propagation, when in reality it's something that was created in a lab and they're testing it on the population. And then again, when I see the CIA's mind control, MKUltra mind control experiments producing the Timothy McVeighs, the Charles Mansons, the Son of Sam's, the Sirhan's, it leads me then to question, what if there's a government that has a population overpopulated and say, well, let's come up with something, some virus making it appear as if it's naturally occurring in the environment, we'll propagate it, and then they'll give us a justification then to pay for the demise of all those affected, therefore reducing the population. You see how I think about all these things.
I would think Ebola, I can tell you're scummy. If you're throwing Timothy McVeigh and Charles Manson in together with Sirhan. But I would think that if Ebola is a good example, almost like if you really wanted to wipe out a population, just go with Ebola, right? I mean, that's still pretty effective. We don't have a cure for Ebola yet, do we?
No. The only cure we have is quarantine. It burns itself out and then jumps back into the simian population. The cynicism with which the gentleman was just speaking, it's in the book I wrote. It's there. I mean, folks have long been willing to kind of pervert science. Science doesn't have any kind of morality attached to it. It's the scientists who have the morality attached to it. And folks have long been willing to pervert its uses for their kind of own means. Yeah. That's why the villains in my book aren't even governments. They're just hedge fund managers. They just want to make a lot of money.
Right. Jimmy is in Fort Myers, Florida, on Coast to Coast. Jimmy?
Yes. Hi, Ian. How you doing?
Hi. You're talking with Dr. Steven Schlotzman, the author of the zombie autopsies. Go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Steven, I'm disabled, and I have occasion to recently be put in a psychiatric facility, and you being a psychiatrist, and it was actually due to just a medical error. Long story short, I was given a medication. I was abruptly stopped on the medication. And it was for seizures, actually for peripheral neuropathy, but it caused psychiatric symptoms. And my question is, when I was placed in this facility, it was short-term just to be evaluated, but I noticed what I saw as a zombification of a lot of people that were not in there for valid reasons. And my question ultimately is, do you think that the United States, in the way they treat the mentally ill or the physically disabled that are being warehoused in psychiatric facilities, is a pandemic of its own?
That's it's an interesting way of phrasing that question, Jimmy. Thank you. Doctor?
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic question. The academic research I do is on stigma and stigmatization, especially psychiatric illnesses, and the tendency towards warehousing. I think we've gotten better. I mean, I'm sorry that you had the experience you had, which sounds awful. If you look at the history of psychiatric hospitalizations, the birth and then unbirthing, I guess, of the asylum, we've gotten better at not warehousing folks. Having said that, there are constraints artificially placed on the system that sort of force us towards something pretty awful, what you're describing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those are sort of insurance constraints. A lot of those are ongoing stigma. We know it would be cost-saving not to do that. We know that the evidence is very clear, and yet we do it anyhow. And so to that extent, it is representative in a pandemic way of the sort of foibles of human nature that I talked about in the book.
I got a little delay there. I think that's a whole other discussion too, what the role of private insurance would be in the spread or the containment of a zombie virus. How would that affect? I mean, who would really good insurance step up? Would all the insurance industries step back? When would insurance policies kick in? Stage two, stage three?
It's the ultimate pre-existing condition. I mean, one of the ironies in the novel that I was trying to get at is once everybody on Earth is infected, which is essentially what happens, all of that stuff becomes meaningless. All of the insurers, none of it matters really, because everyone's sort of equally infected. And that's not to say that it's kind of a utopia. I mean, first of all, people are infected with this awful virus, and people with more money can take better care of themselves than people with less money. But some of those pre-existing conditions, everyone's got it. So
yeah,
it becomes like the new normal.
Well, you know, thank you so much. I loved tonight's show, and I'm grateful that you helped make the radio presentation of the zombie autopsies as compelling but not nearly as graphic as the actual book, The Zombie Autopsies, which is also fascinating. Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse. It's a terrific read. Dr. Stephen Schlotzman, thank you so much. God bless you and all your good work, and help us stay away from the zombie apocalypse, okay?
I will. Thank you so much. It was a blast.
Commit yourself to keep doing your work, either through fiction or in your clinic in any way you can. And we'll do our part here on Coast to Coast. All right, we'll just do open lines for the last hour. If you want to hang on with a zombie comment or a zombie question for me, I'll take it. But otherwise, let's just go open lines. Where do you want to go with the last hour of the show coming up on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett.